We're going to call the committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 4th, 2015. This is the Transportation and Public Safety Committee meeting. Members, we have five bills on the agenda, but we're going to start off with an overview of the Minnesota Vehicle Insurance Coverage Verification Task Force report. We're going to hear from Senator Kent and then Pat McCormick from DVS, and then we have a couple of bills that are related to that subject, and then we'll move on to three bills from Senator Ress that relate to the issue of freight rail in the communities that she represents in nearby communities. So with that, welcome, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This has been an interesting project. As many of you may recall, last session we created a task force to study the issue of uninsured motorists in the state of Minnesota, that all came out because I had represented the issue of public safety on the working group for insurance reform, and so here we are. We established this task force in order to review and evaluate approaches to insurance coverage verification and to recommend legislation to create and fund a program in this state. From July 2014 through February of this year, a 15-member Motor Vehicle Insurance Coverage Verification Task Force met multiple times and assessed the processes and issues related to insurance verification. We did expand the scope. It was a little sort of implied, but we were being very literal about it, to include the question of how we could potentially reduce the uninsured motorist rate. As a bit of background, currently Minnesota law requires drivers to have proof of insurance at all times and to have it on them, to possess it, and to maintain insurance when a vehicle is operated or when its use is contemplated. In terms of the situation about the uninsured motorist, there's been a lot of debate at the time of the working group. Some people were speculating that there was as many as 20% of Minnesota drivers were uninsured. In the course of doing our research, and you'll hear more about this from Ms. McCormick, we learned there's a real lack of data, not only in Minnesota but nationally, on this issue in terms of really understanding in any great detail how many people are uninsured, why, you know, and who they are, because if we want to try to make an improvement, you would, in theory, need to understand who it is and what the barriers are. But what we did settle on is we used a number from the Insurance Resource Council, and they have a methodology that is used across all the states and over a number of years, so it provides the benefit of consistency. And they say that we currently have an uninsured motorist rate of 10.8%. That has declined over time from 15% in 1993 to 13% in 2009, down to 10.8% now. As always, Minnesota is above average. We have, in a good way in this case, our uninsured motorist rate is lower than the national average, and the national average is 12.5%. And basically, the way we verify insurance currently is when there are title transfers and vehicle registration and renewals. Current law asks motorists to attest to having insurance. And then at traffic stops or in the case of a crash, motorists are required to present proof of insurance. And when they can't, there are penalties. They have the opportunity to present at a later date. This is all spelled out, and it's, you know, kind of a busy flow chart when you look at it. And it has been identified that the fact that nobody ever has to prove that they have insurance until there's an interaction with law enforcement, that is potentially a reason why our rates are higher than they need to be. The current system is a manual process by the Department of Public Safety's Driver and Vehicle Services Division. One thing we noted, and this was part of the motivation for doing the task force in the first place, is that there is new technology that is being adopted by states around the country. As anyone can imagine, with the rise of a lot of technological solutions to things, certainly motor vehicle insurance would fall under that heading. And so that was one of the reasons we wanted to examine it at this time and see if there might be opportunities for Minnesota. And it is worth noting that over 30 states do have electronic verification systems. And I believe you guys do have a copy of the full report in your packets. EVP, you will hear that, electronic verification programs, allow users to verify insurance information based on the data of that is a proof of insurance and show that their coverage is current. There are three types of EVP. You can use a book of business download to create a database to verify insurance. You can have an online verification system that allows users to direct the inquiry to an insurer's computer, or there are hybrid versions of these two systems. And it's hard to get a handle on what the costs of those systems are. Ultimately, they're very customized on a per-state basis. And so you would have to get really clear on what it is we would want to try to build in order to effectively cost that out. As I mentioned, data really is limited. There is a lack of reliable, up-to-date data regarding the rates, the characteristics of the drivers, and then again, the cost and effectiveness of the various options that are available for verifying insurance or reducing those rates. And with that, I will turn this over to Ms. McCormick to talk more specifically about the findings and the recommendations of the task force.
Thank you, Senator Kent. Welcome, Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services with the Department of Public Safety. And as the next slide shows, the uninsured motorist rate and the reporting program type. And as you can see, Minnesota's uninsured motorist rate at this time is 10.8%. And with the reporting type, we have no specific reporting program. As Senator Kent said, we have the drivers attest to the fact that they have motor vehicle insurance when they apply for a title and when they renew their registration of their vehicle. The findings of the task force were that there's very many factors that affect the uninsured motorist rate. First of all, there's the state's ability to reduce uninsured motorist rates that depends on a large number of factors, and there's no current valid data to show the importance or the cost of these factors. And the task force reviewed several studies and reports that had been done, and there was not any conclusive information that was similar across any of the studies that we did. Factors that influence the uninsured motorist rate include the socioeconomic factors, public awareness of insurance requirements, enforcement of insurance requirements, and also whatever the state's verification policy is. No verification system will be completely accurate or lead to 100% compliance, and that factor was true in all the studies that we looked at. It's very important that we minimize the errors and that we acknowledge the fact that some people always drive without insurance. So the timing is critical for an electronic verification program. The study of the electronic verification program options should coincide with the MNLARS system development. And the task force felt that in Minnesota, electronic verification program really could not be implemented until our MNLARS project is completed. This also would allow Minnesota more time so that other electronic verification programs that some are fairly new would be able to develop and would allow us to study their effectiveness and also allow the technology to evolve. So we've provided some information on the state trends in uninsured motorists. In terms of Minnesota's uninsured motorist rate, it has declined from previous years. It is also lower than the national rate, which is 12.5%. There has been a fluctuation in Minnesota's uninsured motorist rate and an uninsured motorist rate cycle. There is no data that really helps us to explain the cycle, though. No study has been done that would provide us with that information. Although the uninsured motorist rate has declined, the number of uninsured motorists has increased as the number of motorists in Minnesota has increased. And you can tell from the chart that that number keeps climbing. Oh, they don't have it. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that we had sent that over for the committee members. So
you're working up the full report, I believe, so.
Yeah. Okay. I apologize. I thought that we had sent this over for you to for the committee, so I'm sorry. PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
we'll
send
that to you so that all the members have it. The claim payments for accidents caused by uninsured motorists has decreased along with the insured driver's costs of that claim payment. There are several alternatives that were looked at by the task force, and there were a few that were not recommended, at least not for the time being. One was the, as I mentioned before, the electronic verification program due to required resources working on the MNLARS project. And there were several options that appeared to be easy solutions, but once we further investigated them, it was determined that it wouldn't be feasible or it wasn't desirable for our state. And a few of the examples of that included DWI-style plates for vehicles of insurance violators, and there were various fine options that people felt might be too expensive for uninsured motorists, and as a result would not really help for them to be providing, to be an incentive for them to purchase insurance. So the recommendations that the task force concluded is that a comprehensive approach needs to be taken to address our uninsured motorist problem in Minnesota. And the approach includes possible implementation of an electronic verification system. A potential fifth step would be, or there's four steps approach to the uninsured motorist problem that we believe we can deal with immediately or quickly and not wait for MNLARS. And so I'll go through those recommendations. Recommendation one is DPS should strengthen its proof of insurance requirements and processes. In all DVS transactions, we should be requiring three additional pieces of information as proof of insurance: the insurance company name, the policy number, and the expiration date. People now attest to the fact that they have coverage at the time of vehicle registration and vehicle renewal, but they don't have to show proof of the insurance. The task force believes that this would create an incentive for people to purchase insurance. Recommendation two would be that the state should increase penalties for people who are convicted of driving without insurance or without proof of insurance. One of the recommendations includes asking the Judicial Council to consider removing the no insurance and no proof of insurance offenses from the statewide payables list in order to require insurance violators to go to court. Fines could be more than triple if the maximum fine were assigned by a judge. Currently, a person may mail in the $200 fine and the $75 surcharge rather than appear before a judge. By requiring insurance offenders to appear before a judge, a fine of up to $1,000 may be assigned. Avoiding a large fine is an incentive to purchase insurance. This will cost the courts over $2.4 million a year in order to have a sufficient number of judges to be able to cover the caseload. Recommendation three, the state should implement a public awareness campaign to support new processes and promote compliance with the compulsory insurance law. This would minimize the disruption to the public with the introduction of additional proof requirements at registration and would emphasize the penalties, including fines and license suspensions. The goal for this recommendation is to educate the public about the new proof of insurance requirements at registration renewal By focusing on these consequences, it reminds people that it's illegal to drive without insurance. A public awareness campaign would require the participation of multiple entities and should be across multiple forums. The fourth recommendation is that an ongoing committee or advisory council should be created to help implement the task force recommendations. This would assist the state in developing effective policies, establish goals and direct activities, and would also allow for the measurement and analysis of data, including the effectiveness of the electronic verification program in other programs in other states, as well as the effect of Minnesota policy changes. The suggestion of the task force is that it could be a subgroup of an existing legislative committee, or it could be an independent group that would be similar to the task force. There is little data on uninsured motorists, and this could ensure data is collected and that decisions for future direction are fact-based. And the final recommendation is that the state should reassess the electronic verification program's expected benefits, costs, and the implementation issues. After MNLARS is deployed and operational, this could take place, and the results of stronger proof of insurance requirements would be better known. The state would have already implemented those recommendations that we just talked about, recommendations 1 through 3, and we also would be able to see how this electronic verification programs that are being established in other states, how they are working. We have also put together a chart, and it was based on our presentation with the Commerce Committee. Senator Champion asked us to look at the states that already have put together electronic verification programs and look at whether or not there has been a change in the uninsured motorist rate. And so we did put together the data that we have that we'd like to provide to the committee members. So I have copies of that for all of you to look at.
Page common, and distribute them.
And Mr. Chair, if I can just try to sort of summarize my experience with the task force. I think everybody sort of looks at this problem, and I've actually had constituents contact me because some of this got some attention in the media, and they say, well, we should just make sure everybody has insurance, as if it's just we can just do that. And I think a lot of us on the task force approach this as like, hey, there are some simple solutions out there, right? But once we got into really understanding, you know, what drives the lack of insurance and the fact that there is relatively little data on there, what we sort of netted out with was if we're going to agree to use that 10.8% uninsured motorist rate as our sort of baseline, and that can be off by a couple of percentage points based on experience that we've observed in other states, then the challenge is how do we chip away at that and, you know, try to get closer to 0%. But the reality is the very best state in terms of an uninsured motorist rate is Massachusetts. And they have 3.9% of their drivers are uninsured. So, you know, you can look at that as sort of as far as you're realistically probably going to get anyway. And the task force felt like this idea of coming forward and saying we're going to, you know, require people to present proof when they have registration transactions and then publicizing that, that will be sort of the low-hanging fruit. That is the easiest, least expensive, most common-sense approach that we can take at this point. And what that does is everybody sort of makes their own cost-benefit analysis. You know, it costs so much to have insurance, and what are the risks if you don't, right? So they're all making their own personal decisions on this. And this hopefully will help change some of that personal equation to provide an incentive for people to follow the law and have insurance on their vehicles. Beyond that group of people, and Ms. McCormick talked some about the penalties, there was a lot of interest in looking at the issues of multiple offenders, people who have been caught without insurance multiple times, and are there things we can do to ratchet up the penalties in those cases. And that's why the suggestion is there to approach the judiciary and see if there is something they can do to help. One suggestion is, in cases where there might have been another offense, often the insurance violation will get thrown out, so you don't have the ability to track repeat offenses. So just sort of trying to open that discussion and bring it to people's attentions. And then, but any of the other steps that we would take with the different populations, you know, in this committee we talk a lot about transportation and transit. Well, if people have to have a car to get to their job, but their job doesn't pay them enough to effectively own and insure and operate a car, they're having to make some tough choices. And, you know, just making that law tougher isn't necessarily going to solve that problem. And so, you know, we discussed a number of scenarios where you can imagine that it might not just be tougher laws and tougher enforcement that would provide the solutions that we're talking about. So what I really appreciated about the task force was all of us came in with one sort of view of how this all works, and after we spent a lot of time studying other states and their experiences and the data that we do have and the data that we don't have, it was a much more nuanced understanding, and with the realization that to try to really get close to that, you know, the lowest number we think we could realistically ever get to would need more information for sure, and, you know, it could potentially start getting more expensive. So that's why this recommendation at this time is the low-hanging fruit.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. McCormick, refresh my memory here. I thought at one time we did this, and then we decided not to do it anymore, and consequently we have the law as it is right now. So am I right about that, or am I wrong?
You're somewhere in the middle.
Somewhere in the middle.
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, we had a random sampling program that wasn't very effective, and the public really, it was not helpful to us in terms of really being able to accomplish much. We sent out notices and asked people to respond and let us know what they had for insurance, and people a lot of times wouldn't even open the letters. They would just think it was an ad and they'd throw it out, and then the next thing you know, we were revoking them for no proof of insurance, and it was not a program that worked well. And so the legislature, and I think it was 2006, ended the program.
Okay.
And so at that time we decided to go a few years later, we decided to go with attesting to the fact versus bringing in proof of insurance when you renew your tabs or when you're registering a vehicle. The reason being because we didn't have any way to record that information, and so we had files of information, but it was not easily available to us to really enforce the law. The task force felt very strongly that we needed to recommend the fact that we need to start, DVS should be starting to have people demonstrate that they do have proof of insurance at the time of vehicle registration and registration renewal. And that's one of the recommendations.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. McCormick, I knew there was something about it because this bill seems to make some sense, especially since if you get stopped by a highway patrol, they ask for proof of insurance and you're supposed to have it on you. And so it just seems to me that we should be able to do it. But I thought there was a reason why we changed the law to the point where you just have to attest to the fact that you have insurance. And I thought there was some kind of a problem with presenting a proof of insurance card, which was why we did it this way. But it's not exactly that, right?
Correct.
Okay.
I had a quick question for, if I could take the chair's prerogative quickly, Senator Kiffmeyer. Just about the
right,
experience of
right.
other states, Ms. McCormick or Senator Cannon, looking at the chart you handed out. And also I was wondering how Massachusetts does so well. If you read from kind of right to left, looks like most states are in good shape relative to 95, 97, with a couple of exceptions. Florida's doing worse. South Carolina's doing way better, though. But it seems like kind of consistently in the middle there where we hit the recession, it got a little bit worse. So I think that would be some validation of the socioeconomic issues that you talked about. But the question begs: A, how is it that Massachusetts is doing so well? And B, seems like the improvements are not huge for having implemented electronic verification programs. I was just wondering if you had any response.
Mr. Chair, there are two things going on. For one thing, basically the sample size when you look at states is just small because there's only 50 to start with, and then they've all got different approaches. And then they've all implemented them at different times, and that was the point of Senator Champion's question that led to this chart. Can we try to draw some correlations? For example, Alabama has just implemented a really pretty ambitious system, but it's brand new, so we won't see that data yet. We did try to take the state data and do correlations with socioeconomic factors or with the type of process that the states are using, and the answer was there really are not obvious correlations that are apparent. And so that is why it's exactly what you said. What we see with different states making different efforts is you're just sort of chipping away at that number in the best case scenario. And I think you're exactly right. One of the observations was that there does seem to be some overall economic vitality correlation with the trends in uninsured motorists.
And how does Massachusetts get all the way down to 3% uninsured?
I mean, I think, Mr. Chair, one of the reasons is, Massachusetts is really high on a lot of the good list, much like Minnesota is.
All right. Very good. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good question. I think for one of the things on the attesting, when you get to these percentages, how do you know? You have an attesting thing. How do you know somebody is or is not? So how do they get to these 10.8%, not just 10 or 11, but 10.8?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kent.
And Senator Kiffmeyer, that 10.8% number comes from the Insurance Resource Council. It does not use any of our actual data. And because in trying to measure uninsured motorists, you're trying to measure the unknown, there's really no effective way for us other than trying to go out and do some really massive survey that would be very expensive for us to try to measure that. What the Insurance Research Council does is they have a methodology. Let me see if I can find it. We have it in our notes. It is the uninsured motorist to bodily injury frequency ratio. It is a math. It is a measure that the Insurance Research Council uses. And the reason we settled on that as the best one we could use, as I said, is it is measured consistently across states. So it helps us try to evaluate what might be more or less successful. And it's been used over time so we can use the trends. Other than that, there are no consistent ways of getting at this number.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I just on a follow-up on that, I think that's what we have to remember. It sounds so precise. It is not.
Right.
And so I think the other challenge it leads to, then how do you know when you have success? Because that's also an extrapolation and unknown. So I just have a concern that way because we're not dealing with things so precise. But the assumption is we know it's happening, which is interesting, that in this case we can assume and know fraud is happening. In other cases, that's denied. Interesting.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, if I can just add a little to that, one thing that we did look at is in states that have more aggressively pursued some of this data, we would compare what they came up with as an uninsured motorist rate to the Insurance Research Council rate, and they tended to be fairly close, give or take a couple of percentage points. So what we thought was significant was that we at least are in the ballpark. And like I said, when this first came up, there were people speculating that we had a 20% uninsured motorist rate in Minnesota. And I think everybody, after looking at all the data, feels pretty comfortable that that's probably not reflective of our reality, that we really are somewhere closer to the 10 to 12 number.
Well, Matt, Mr. Chair, I think the other thing is that I do hope that one of the solutions here is talking about fines. When I think of people who are in that situation and already affording to pay insurance, then you fine them $1,000, which is what they could have used to pay for the insurance. I would rather it be used for the insurance, not for fines. Then the other thing is just the going to court and some of that are $2.45 million a year. So I think the overarching goal has to be very focused on that. So I think your bill coming up, the proof of insurance, which we were discussing and thinking we thought already was that you had to do it, similar to what Senator Tomasoni thought. So that's not such a big deal. But I just wanted to comment that I hope we do not go to criminalizing too excessively, or that we put our resources to actually getting insurance, because if you pay a fine but you don't have insurance, I don't know that you're all that much far ahead, because the tendency is for them to not respond to those things anyway. So I just hope that I think the one point, though, is that attesting to coverage has always been a question. But thanks for the report. Thank you.
Further, Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just a point of clarification. I know this is one of Senator Rest Peeves. Do we know where this came from? Is this from Senator Kent? Is this from the agency? There's no defining marks on it.
Oh, Senator Osmond, this was handed out by Ms. McCormick from the desk.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So we saw it with our own eyes that it came from her hands.
Okay.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might have just a couple of questions. To the exhibit, can you explain the highlighting? What am I supposed to take away from what's highlighted and what's not?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, I was going to explain that just to make sure that you understand that the ones that are in white are the ones where they've had a decrease, at least in the change, since they've been on the electronic verification program. And it was just a way for us to differentiate between the two. And so I just wanted to make sure that you understood that that was the case.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Pratt.
So, Ms. McCormick, if I look at California, it looks like a pretty big change from 22% down to 14. But yet it's white. Is there a reason why we're not counting California in that change?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, the ones that are in white, which includes California, that means that they have decreased.
Oh.
So that's what that
and
is
the,
supposed
and
to
be. And the yellow has increased from 95-97 to present day? So the yellow is
yes,
the opposite.
Yes, the yellow is that means that it,
okay.
that it hasn't it hasn't had the same kind of a decrease.
Well,
that the electronic verification program has not necessarily made the difference that they thought it would.
Oh, even though there's a decrease in some of this, it's not attributable to the electronic verification.
Correct.
All right. Thank you. Senator Pratt.
Okay, so I guess that answers the question I would have had on Colorado and why that one was. But what you're saying is that's not, even though that dropped, the book of business has been downloaded since 2004, and we saw a drop from 32% down to 15%. You're saying it's not attributable to verification.
This is how we're interpreting the information we got from the Insurance Research Council. So.
And, Mr. Chair?
Senator Kent.
I would also add, like, if you look at Texas, for example, which is at the top of the second page, it's indicating that the system has been used since 2008. But one of the reasons I got interested in this issue was my husband and I were living in Texas when they, 20 years ago, began a process of doing a manual proof of insurance. And it was a big issue in the state, and there was a lot of press, and a lot of people had to change the way they'd always done things. And so a big part of it was a public awareness and public understanding that, oh, I got to pay attention to this. So there are subtleties in these histories that we can't necessarily observe with this data. You know, states have been trying to tackle this issue in a variety of ways for over a range of timelines.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the bill. I think it's a step in the right direction. We saw this in Commerce earlier this week, and to me, it's still missing a piece, and it's missing that verification piece. Whether manual or electronic, there's nothing that stops somebody from writing down a policy number that's expired. So it doesn't add a lot of teeth to the, you know, attesting that you have insurance, even though it kind of feels good. And if I recall, 2 years ago, we talked about this issue when we first did the tour of Menlars at DVS. And walk through the project plan, and we were told, well, that can be for a future phase. We've got to keep the scope of Menlars fairly tight. And I think we walked away agreeing with that, with the expectation that we would be at some sort of electronic verification. No verification system is going to be 100%. There's always going to be false positives. there's always going to be false negatives. But what it does do is it allows us to clear a large majority of people, get them very efficiently processed through, have some confidence that at least at the point in time that they bought their tabs, that they did have insurance in force. Now, we can't stop them if they cancel it. There's a lot of bad things that can happen, but at least we've got that. And so then your department's really only spending time on the outliers, which should be a far lower number, and still provide a better level of protection than what I think we've got in this bill. So I appreciate the work that's been done. I appreciate this step, but Mr. Chair, I don't recall when we did the tour of DBS, I thought this committee had kind of informally expected some sort of electronic verification to be on the horizon, and maybe Ms. McCormick can tell us when that might be on the project plan.
So, Senator Pratt, 2018. I think the recommendation number 5 speaks to that. The state should reassess EVP's expected benefits, costs, and implementation issues after MNLARS is implemented and operational. So they did touch on it, but Ms. McCormick, if you want to expand a little bit.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senator Pratt, the basic plan for MNLARS implementation is to be completed in 2017, and so any additional enhancements that would be made would have to occur after that time, and that's basically what the task force report talks about in the report itself, that it would have to be completed in 2017 and thereafter. So.
Oh, 2018 is going to be a beautiful year. So much is going to happen. Senator Champion, and then members, we need to move on to the two bills that have to do with this subject, because then we've got a series of bills to hear about from Senator Ress. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Kin, thank you for all your work that you have put into this bill. I have a couple questions. Maybe it's more around the practicality of it. So as a insured driver in the state of Minnesota, if this bill was to be implemented, then would I go online as a carrier and upload my information with the name of my insurance company, policy number, and what is it, and the expiration date for my vehicle? Is that what I would do?
Let me pause for 1 second. Members, do we have any more questions to the report itself that don't pertain to Senate File 1108?
Oh.
If not, we can move right to Senate File 1108. So why don't we just segue. All right.
Segue.
So that was the segue. Senator
okay,
Champion's question. We're now on Senate File 1108.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. I just.
No, you're good to go.
You made a very smooth transition. I appreciate it, Senator
okay,
Champion.
Good.
Thank you for doing that.
Okay, thank you. And so would I, you know, then upload all this information? And if so, then would I be required, once my policy expired, to then upload the new information? And so if you can help me with that first, then that'll lead me to my next compound question.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, Driver and Vehicle Services has three ways that you can renew your registration. You can, as you said, you can renew it online. You can also come into a deputy registrar office and renew your registration that way, which is done. It's about 84% of our customers go into a deputy registrar office. And you can do it by mail. And that's about 10% renew online, and the rest are 10 to 12% online, and then the rest are done by mail. And in each of those ways, we would have to have that information as part of the registration renewal form that you would have to be able to provide if you were doing it on by mail or at a deputy registrar office. If you're doing it online, that would have to be part of our online application for tab renewals. So it would be in, it would require us to make those changes so that we could implement this legislation that Senator Kent is sponsoring right now.
And And Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, then just for the rest, the other part of your question, no, when your insurance renews, you don't have to make any updates. It's only at the time that you would be renewing your registration.
Okay.
Senator Champion.
So, Mr. Chair, so then with that being said, so what would happen if I was stopped by the police, which happens on a regular basis? And let's say I've mailed in my information. That information has not been placed into the system. What would happen under those circumstances, and what would happen under those circumstances? There you go. And or would there be a requirement for me to provide some lead time before when my insurance would expire if I want to get it like every 6 months or something like that? Because there are some people who pay a monthly premium. And so if you can help me with the practicality of that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, whenever there's any kind of violation, and especially serious violations or crashes, our staff call the insurance company. So we would have a record on file that you would have on your tab renewal application, and we would have that on our file. We would call that insurance carrier and verify that you had insurance. So we would be checking beyond just what's on that card that you might have to verify the insurance. So we do that right now with anybody that's in a crash or there's a serious violation. So we check on the insurance, and we call the carrier, not the insurance agent, usually to verify that information.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Kent.
And Senator Champion, this has come up in some other conversations about this bill. None of the laws about requirement of insurance and when you have to show proof of insurance in the case of crashes or traffic stops, none of that is changing with this bill. All of those things are still the same as they have been. The only thing here is that in the cases of going to the language here, during when we are applying for registration, re-registration, or transfer of ownership, instead of attesting, now you have to provide those three pieces of information.
So Senator Kent, so this the subject of Senate File 1108 has to do with license tab renewals and proving that you have insurance at that point in time.
Yep.
The proof you need to provide of insurance at a point at which you have some interaction with the police is a different matter. Right? You have to have the little card, or I don't know, Senator Kent or Senator Eakin has a bill that's going to change that a little bit. But are you saying those are two separate matters?
Yes.
Proof of insurance when you renew your license tab fees. Proof of insurance when you're involved in some sort of traffic matter.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you for that clarification, and I think you do a very good job of clarifying these things for us so that we are on the right pathway. But perhaps you can help clarify for me then what's the purpose of the bill. Because if the whole reason is that I'm providing this information, what's the purpose? Because if I have to drive down the street, get stopped by the police or anything, I have to provide the same information that I would have to provide if I go there to renew my registration or whatever I am supposed to do. So I'm trying to understand, and I did write down here, why do we need to implement this proposed policy?
Mr. Chair Senator Champion, the feelings of the task force were pretty strongly that the simple act of attestation, checking a box and signing your name, promising that you have insurance, has not provided a strong enough incentive for people to comply with the existing law about maintaining active insurance. And so that by asking people to document some details, which, yes, some people could still falsify that information if they were so inclined, but by having one more occasion where they have to provide some details about it, that is going to help reduce the number of uninsured motorists.
So, Senator Kent, sorry, Senator Champion, I don't mean to steal the question back from you. So at the point at which you are renewing your tabs, you do not need to provide the insurance card per se. You simply need to write down the name of the company, policy number, and the expiration date. But you don't need to show a clerk your card the way you would have to show a police officer your card. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, because of the fact that we have three different ways that you can renew your tabs, you wouldn't be able to show it if you're sending it through the mail registration renewal or you're doing it online. I think the legislation in that respect just talks about providing that information. Obviously, if you're in our office, you're in a deputy registrar office, you could do that, but I think the issue is just to make sure that they're accurately recording that information, and a lot of it, as you probably read in parts of the report, is also the public information campaign that needs to go along with this so that the public really understands that we're taking this seriously and that there can be follow-up and that kind of thing. So I think the two go hand in hand. But because we also want to offer our customers different ways to be able to renew their tabs, we wanted to at least put it in the, you know, Senator Kent captured what the task force.
Right, you need to do that every time, Senator. thank you. Anything further on Senate Files 1108? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, Senator Champion, as to your question, which is why I find that we're discussing the issue here, but the whole point of having insurance is for body and car injury, either somebody else's or yours. So I wanted to ask the question of whether they pick you up, you have proof or all that. That's all that process, but the whole point of having insurance. So maybe somebody from the insurance agency, what happens when somebody does not have insurance, whether it's proved by paper, electronic, or anything else? What happens when they don't have an insurance and there is an accident? I mean, this is what this is for. In that unfortunate situation that you're in, that what happens when somebody does not have insurance? And Senator Kent, if somebody's here from the Insurance Association, they maybe can address what this means when somebody does not have insurance. It looks like we have somebody maybe.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm amused because the insurance representatives tend to be with us on a regular basis on this issue, and I actually don't. Oh, there we are.
Got one.
But I will say, while
how could we discuss this without them somewhere in the room?
While we're waiting for this commentary on it, I do want to say I want to thank you for bringing that up. I mean, we have this law for a reason, and the task force did spend quite a bit of time talking about that this becomes an unfair transfer of burden from law-abiding citizens who have their insurance. I mean, I happened to be rear-ended the other day. I haven't actually had to show my insurance to anybody in years, and I did just last week. And I was really glad that the person who rear-ended me also has insurance. But it drove home that point. If they hadn't, that all falls on me, you know, and my insurance company. So thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Mark Kulda. I'm with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. The simple answer to your question is if you're involved in an accident with a person who does not have insurance, then your own insurance policy would cover it under the coverage that's required in Minnesota, known as the uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage. So in Minnesota, we have mandated coverages, and one of them is uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage. And if you're involved in an accident with somebody who doesn't have insurance and you do have insurance, your own insurance would have coverage under the UIUM coverage.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So to clarify, if person A has insurance and person B does not, person A just pays for their own expenses, what happens to the expenses of person B who doesn't have insurance?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, that would be on person B then. Person B didn't have insurance, and so whatever cost they incur is on themselves for not having insurance. They would not have any coverage for their own injuries and then also for whatever damage they may have caused if they're at fault in the accident.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to follow up to that,
Senator Kiffmeyer,
it appears as though that in that situation, though, I think for the public interest, you know, that we're looking at here, they still have expenses of either injury or of their vehicle or other property sustained in that regard that has to be borne by someone somewhere, either that particular motorist or in a car, so on and so forth. But those who do carry insurance have those things covered by virtue, like you said, of the requirements of the insurance. And so my question, Mr. Chairman, is if somebody doesn't have an insurance and has some injuries or other things like that, who does pay in that regard? I would expect that they would have to. Is that a personal absorption? Is there a state interest here where the state picks up bodily harm many times?
Well, Senator
anybody
Kiffmeyer,
who could
think,
answer
yeah,
that.
I think or Ms. the short answer to your question is yes. And, you know, they probably entertained a lot of financial liability of their own for paying for their own injuries, damage that they've caused. Sometimes when they can't pay, of course, that's, you know, we're very familiar with that issue in Hennepin County where it's picked up by the property taxpayer if they're receiving treatment at Hennepin County Medical Center for unreimbursed costs. So the costs get socialized, if you will. They get spread out among all the rest of us. And, of course, insurance rates are a little bit higher because of that. Anyone else want to take a stab at it? Members, there clearly is a lot more interest in this than I anticipated. We have to get to Senator Rest's bill. We have a whole room full of people here and almost a little over a half hour. So I'm going to table this bill in just about a second. We're going to come back to it at our next hearing.
Okay.
So did you want to answer that question?
Mr. Chair, I think you articulated it very well.
Right. So, members, we're going to table Senate File 1108, and Senator Eakin, we're going to come back to your bill another day. My apologies. Senator Rest. So, members, I'm going to make an announcement right now. We only have a couple of weeks left till deadlines. This committee likes to do the deep dive into every subject that comes before us. This committee is going to start meeting for longer than an hour and a half, just as a standard practice. So we have the room until 5 o'clock, whenever we do have committee. So we can probably expect to stay till 5 because you guys are really, really diligent. present. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today I'm going to be bringing before you three separate bills. Two of them are deal with a similar subject matter, and so I'm going to deal with those two first, and to try and even before that to establish the narrative that occasions these bills to be brought before us. The third bill, which is 1251, I would like to deal with a little bit later, as it deals with a different subject matter in terms of the proposal, and it comes to us from Hennepin County. So with your permission, I will do that. And I'm going to invite the mayor of Robbinsdale, Mr. Sutter from Crystal, to come up here to go through the narrative, and then I'll talk a little bit about the bills, the two bills that deal with EIS. But even before that, I'd like to direct your attention to the photograph over here. I think all of us are aware of in the last few weeks of a huge train wreck in Mount Carbon, West Virginia. BNSF or CP train. CSX is the was the company. Was 109 cars with two locomotives, 107 oil cars, and two buffers. The cars themselves were, and I don't really know the meaning of it, but for those of us that are familiar, they the models were CPC 1232. 25 tank cars derailed. 20 other cars were involved in subsequent fires. 100 to 125 residents were evacuated. Thankfully, no one was seriously injured. But if you look at the photograph, and I realize that some around those tracks, there are not a lot of houses. There's one building that's clearly leveled, and obviously there were no people in it because they would have been incinerated. The packet of materials that you have in your folders include a letter from Governor Dayton to Deb Miller, who is the acting chair of the Surface Transportation Board, which has jurisdiction over, federal jurisdiction over the issues that are before us today, in support of my communities. Secondly, are resolutions from three of my cities that are directly affected. The other two are dealing with them as well, and those cities that we have today are Crystal, Robbinsdale, and Golden Valley. And then following that are some are some articles dealing with the proposal for the connector in Crystal between CP and BNSF. There is a short op-ed piece from the mayors of Crystal, Golden Valley, New Hope, and Robbinsdale. There's also an article recalling the study that's just been produced by the, or at least released by the Department of Transportation on what we can anticipate of oil trains, how many a year derailing and having crashes or accidents of one sort or the other, and what the cost would be projected both in dollars and in human life. And I will note, because I'm sure not everybody can read through it all, that the railroad industry does dispute their findings. And then finally, an article from Trains Magazine, which again gives a little bit more background about the relationship of the railroads over the years in our area with regard to the Soo lines, as well as CP, BN, and now BNSF. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to call upon Mayor Murphy and Mr. Sutter to take you through a narrative that is in your packets, and then I would turn to the two bills, one of which is a resolution and the other an actual direction to the state regarding environmental impact statements relative to the projects that are being proposed by the railroads.
And Senator Rest, I'll just also call the committee's attention to the letter distributed also to the Surface Transportation Board from Congressman Ellison.
Thank you. Yes.
Mayor Murphy, welcome. And Community Development Director Sutter, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed as you wish.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for having us here today. On behalf of the City of Crystal, I appreciate that you have made time to hear us on this issue, which is of great concern to our communities. First, a little bit about Crystal. Crystal is a first-ring suburb, or inner-ring suburb, of about 23,000 people. It was largely developed in the period right after World War II. It was fully built out by about 1970. And we learned in November that the railroads were talking to property owners in the city of Crystal about building a connector track through areas currently occupied by operating businesses. And it took about 2.5 months before we got any real information from either of the railroads. The meeting that we had on February 4th with the railroads was the first real understanding we had of exactly what they were proposing. What we learned from that meeting is that BNSF has indicated that the first thing they were going to do to build this connection, which would divert traffic from the red line, which is the CP, Senator.
Microphone, so I'm wondering if there's some other equipment in the building that is related to the construction, is what I suspect, so we're just going to have to put up with it. Thanks. So
track to connect these two lines here and then divert, our understanding is, eastbound CP trains south on the BNSF line, which would then connect to BNSF's Wayzata subdivision here near the interchange of 394 and I-94 just southwest of downtown Minneapolis. And then from there the trains would continue east behind or under Target Field, depending on your point of view, across the Mississippi into northeast Minneapolis, and then continue to the east from there. As we understand it, the primary purpose of the connector would be to divert these trains to relieve congestion elsewhere on that CP line. But it's important to note that once the connector is built, we really don't know that that's all that the CP is going to do. Certainly, it might facilitate the addition of even more traffic on this main line overall. And for that reason, it might increase train traffic to the west of the connector through New Hope, Plymouth, and so forth. Now, getting back to the concerns of the city of Crystal, in addition to the obvious issues of private property taking by the railroad, next slide, please. In this area here, which is where the connector would be built, we're also concerned about the characteristics of the BNSF line, again, which runs south from the connection point down there. Next, please. And this is an illustration of the connector through those business properties. This is the BNSF over here, and this is the CP. Next, please. So this BNSF line has very little traffic. It has a handful of trains per week, perhaps one round trip a day at most. Those trains typically are about 10 to 15 cars long. So this line is, and for a long time has been, very little used by the BN. The line currently dead ends in the vicinity of Monticello and does not have a lot of traffic on it. The CP line, by contrast, carries dozens of long freight trains a day, and some in excess of 1 mile long. Right now in Crystal, we have sort of an escape route. Let's say it's a police officer heading north from City Hall to a call in the northern third of the city. Right now, if as they're approaching the Canadian Pacific line on Douglas Drive, heading north, they see the crossing arms come down, they are able to divert over here to Corvallis Avenue, cross the BN, which, again, has very little traffic on it, get to Botanal Boulevard, and then proceed north on an existing overpass over the Canadian Pacific. In other words, we can work around the current inconvenience of the long freight trains. However, a single 1 mile long freight diverted down the connector to the BNSF line towards Robbinsdale would close all five at-grade crossings located between Winnetka Avenue and New Hope and Highway 100 and Robbinsdale, which is a track distance of over 2 miles. So what that might mean is if you're a police officer heading north and right about here the gate, the crossing arms come down, you're sort of trapped in a cul-de-sac at that point. You either have to decide that you're going to do about a 2 mile round trip to the west to Winnetka Avenue and New Hope, hope that that at-grade crossing is not also blocked, or you have to divert and backtrack south to 42nd Avenue and Highway 100, go under the BNSF to Botanal Boulevard and then go north from there, which is a round trip of about 3 miles in terms of the extra time. So this concern is front and center for the city of Crystal. We've always had this escape route via Corvallis Avenue to Botanal Boulevard. We would not have that escape route anymore. And there are other areas of concern besides Crystal and Robbinsdale, as I mentioned earlier. This connection may allow an overall increase in freight traffic through the Twin Cities area. The one thing that ties all of these communities together up and down the line is that we feel these impacts need to be thoroughly and fully understood. And from that, alternatives considered and mitigation measures identified. We believe that the only way for that to happen is for the Surface Transportation Board to order a full environmental impact statement of this connection and the changes it would mean in freight patterns in the Twin Cities metro area. And that is why, while each community up and down the line has its own unique challenges and circumstances related to this proposal, the EIS is critical for all of us to understand what the implications of this connector track would be. So thank you again, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and for taking time to listen to the City of Crystal's concerns. And Mayor Murphy of Robbinsdale, I don't know if you want to switch places, and I'll operate the PowerPoint for you. You're okay? Okay.
Welcome, Mayor Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. It's an honor to be here. My name is Regan Murphy, Mayor of Robbinsdale. I've been in Robbinsdale all of my life, along with my folks. and never have we had to deal with something so frightful and disruptive to our community. This proposed rail project is a crisis for us, and I'm here on behalf of Robbinsdale and her residents to earn your support, to be quite frank, to help us stop this disastrous project. So I'm just kind of go through a summary of some of the issues, beginning first with kind of the layout of the city of Robbinsdale. It's a small city. Population is roughly 14,000. And looking at the map, you'll see four circles, and each of those circles on the map represent at-grade rail crossings. Because of the topography of Robbinsdale, we are unable to do above or below grade, meaning when the train comes through the proposed train, it'll affect all of these different intersections through our city. As John had mentioned, there's roughly one to two trains each day, never on the weekends. These trains are anywhere from 5 to 7 cars, and they clear all three downtown crossings in less than 1 minute. If the proposed rail connection were to go through, trains would be coming through 24/7 at lengths of up to a mile, which would take over 5 minutes for the train to clear each section. So this is a major change in rail services and has very significant negative impacts to our community. And a bare minimum, we ask that there is an environmental impact statement to identify the local safety and security hazards and then determine mitigation requirements. One other thing to note, the second circle down is County Road 9, probably our busiest intersection. 1,500 vehicles per day travel this intersection. That does not include the pedestrians, the children, mine included. I have 3 that are 10, 8, and 5 as of today that cross this on a daily basis to church, to our businesses, to our grade schools. So very important intersection. In all of my life, I can count on my hands the number of times I've been stopped by a train in Robbinsdale. I turned 40 a couple days ago. I've been in Robbinsdale for 40 years, so maybe 35 years. I do not remember. I can recollect on less than 10 times I've been stopped by a train in Robbinsdale. That's how much it currently does not impact our community. One other note on this map, right in the middle, the blue square, that's our police and fire building. Strategically located centrally in our community, you'll note it's right at one of the at grade crossings, so the train would affect our volunteer firefighters, their ability to get to the station and then also respond to a call. Right now, our volunteer firefighters can respond, get to the station in 3 minutes on average. This would increase to 8 minutes if they encountered a mile-long train. This does not include all the traffic congestion caused by six-minute road closure, which at peak would stop traffic movement in all of downtown and block access all around their police and fire building. This map is a good depiction of our downtown area, which is highlighted in yellow. Again, the circles are at-grade crossings, and the non-highlighted areas is primarily residential. Our authentic downtown, for those that have been to Robbinsdale, know it defines us. It defines who we are as a community. It's the character of our city, and it's a way of life for us. Next to our residents, downtown Robbinsdale is our biggest asset. The noise, vibration, and traffic disruption from 100 freight cars rumbling through town will negatively impact our ability to maintain the economic viability we've worked so hard to have, and it risks our future development. Even the proposal in conversations I've had when I'm trying to get new businesses to come to Robbinsdale are asking me about this. It's fresh on their minds, and they're questioning on whether or not they should come to Robbinsdale because of this project. Also on this map, you'll note the number of residential homes that abut the right-of-way. Thank you for helping with the highlighter. Looking at the map, the densely packed homes within the right-of-way throughout Robbinsdale, there's 100 homes that are within 50 feet of the right-of-way. And our main municipal water well, as well as our water tower, which are highlighted by those squares, are within 75 feet of the rail corridor. So next, looking at traffic, the traffic impact is quite significant. So right now it is a sleepy spur line that ends in Monticello, hauling 5 to 7 cars of benign cargo could become a highway for hundreds of cars with volatile oil or other chemicals that would come all the time at any time. The 100 rail cars would cause never seen before congestions for our residents, our visitors, our hospital, and of course our emergency personnel. And a long train, a mile long, which is depicted by the long red line, showing that would be blocking at any given time all of our at-grade crossings. It would also, for those that are trying to avoid the train and vehicles, it would flood dozens of vehicles into our neighborhoods for those impatient drivers trying to avoid trains, which I'm sure we've all been guilty of. So you can imagine the amount of traffic pouring through our neighborhoods. Other things to note on this map, too. I know it's hard to see, committee members, but the blue square, again, is our police and fire building. The pink around the map shows the traffic congestion that would build up, which almost completely encircles our police and fire safety building and would jam up our downtown. So this is similar to Crystal, a major concern as we share resources with our surrounding communities, most recently in New Hope. You're aware of the incident that happened at our city council, perfect example of how we helped respond to that incident. So this would affect more than just Robbinsdale. I think that was it. The difference between these two slides is just showing that the train, as it enters Robbinsdale, blocks all four at-grade intersections, and even as it's exiting, it still blocks all four at-grade intersections. This last slide is quite impactful, and this is what really bothers me. The last slides really have to do with the potential risk of an oil car derailment. So the large circle superimposed on this map represents the blast radius that happened in 2013 with the Quebec explosion caused by the derailment of oil cars. Granted, this is a worst-case scenario, but it's a real threat if this project moves forward. My home, my church, my children's school, my neighbors, and the lifeblood of our community are all within this impact zone. That's the dotted line represents just the impact zone carried out through the rail corridor. But today, we have an opportunity to try and prevent this from happening. So in closing, as an elected official responsible for the well-being of Robbinsdale, our residents, I ask that you please pass these three bills presented before you today to help us in Robbinsdale and our neighboring communities continue to prosper in our strong and vibrant cities, and of course in beautiful Robbinsdale. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Mayor Murphy. Members, with your indulgence, we'll go to Senator Rest. I guess I'll defer to you and how you want to handle the rest of the presentation. We have a number of witnesses on the list.
At this point, Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do is to actually present the first two bills.
Great.
And then have additional testimony.
Great.
From interested parties on them.
Very
if
good.
That would be okay.
So, Senator Rest, did you want to start with an order here? Senate File 886.
Yes.
And then 1074.
The two gentlemen, the two testifiers to date, referenced the Surface Transportation Board, which has a measure of authority over the railroads in the United States. And what it does is to it's a resolution to memorialize them to require an environmental impact statement for the rail connector track that is being proposed in Crystal. It is similar, if in the packet of materials, to the words are very similar to the resolutions that have been passed by the three cities that you have in the packet, and I'll just go right to the resolve, and it is to bring the legislature into support insofar as it's asking the Surface Transportation Board to order an environmental impact statement, and it is something that the Surface Transportation Board may do if it deems that it is appropriate. There is a in meeting with some representatives from the railroads affected, BNSF, CP was not there. They indicated that opponents of projects like this often prefer to suggest that an EIS be done rather than an environmental assessment, an EAW, because it takes longer, and that somehow is the major consideration of opponents in asking for one rather than the other. But it's also the case that an EIS involves analysis of alternatives, and that is what we also would like the railroads to consider. Are there alternatives? An EAW would not give you that. If the Surface Transportation Board would do that, there would be the opportunity for an analysis of alternatives, and also, as I understand it, and I certainly do not have a lawyer's understanding of this, it would allow the affected communities plenty of time to comment on the proposals and on the alternatives. So I would hope that that the committee would consider this resolution for the legislature to send to the Surface Transportation Board, Acting Chair Miller, and it also would reinforce the letter that Governor Dayton wrote that is dated February 19th, that he wrote to the Acting Chair, Deb Miller, of the Surface Transportation Board. And in addition to that, last Monday, he met with her and also expressed his support for our communities in requesting the EIS for them to do. The second bill is is a direction to the state to conduct an environmental impact statement, and require an environmental impact statement prior to the construction of certain rail tracks, and that would be this connector. That's a little bit more problematical, but we want to explore all avenues. Railroads are under the jurisdiction, by and large, of the federal government, and states often find themselves on the short end when they are promoting safety and when they are promoting environmental sensitivity to projects that are being brought forward by the railroads. So there's to start with, there's this two-prong approach here. One is to, in Senate File 886, is to memorialize the Surface Transportation Board, the Chair Miller, to have the federal government do an EIS, and then the second bill is to ask for one at the state level. I have been in conversation with the Department of Transportation, MnDOT, and also with the Pollution Control Agency about these possibilities. There certainly are differences. They are, as I understand it, they are more nuanced between a state EIS and a federal EIS. Certainly we would prefer the federal one, but we would also like to move forward with suggesting of state one and hoping that legislation actually would not be necessary and that the railroads themselves would see that it would be a valuable step for them to cooperate with us in. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would invite the other testifiers, except for at least on proponents of my bills, except for Commissioner Opat, to talk about the EIS proposals and their experience with the railroads. And then following that, I would request action on those two, and then we would get to the third bill that is coming from Hennepin County, if that's agreeable.
It is agreeable. Thank you.
And then, Mr. Chairman, of course, there is a representative here from the railroads, and you can invite his testimony at any point you'd like.
So, members are obviously going to go over. We'll try to be done by 4.
At this point, and I would point out that the mayors of all 5 of my cities, all 5 of them, are impacted by this project. And are that all 5 cities in my district are impacted by this project, certainly most critically in Crystal and Robbinsdale, but the other 3, in Golden Valley too, but the other 3 a little bit less so. So, Mr. Chairman, we do have Shep Harris, the mayor of Golden Valley, and Kelly Slawick, the mayor of Plymouth here, and I would ask them to come forward. And also, since the city of Minneapolis is impacted, if the city at the other end, Mr. Ranieri from the city of Minneapolis, and we could just go down through their testimony if there are any questions, and then we can get through this testimony, I hope, in an efficient manner.
I hope so, too. We do have 2 questions for Senator Peterson, then Senator Westrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is mainly for you. I know you've mentioned the time a couple times here already, and it appears to me as I reviewed these materials, we're kind of dealing with a rail congestion issue along a rail freight rail corridor. And, and I'm from St. Cloud, and I'm very sensitive to this. We have 47 trains that come through St. Cloud, and I think we have 5 surface crossings. So I'm very familiar with these issues. And there's always, in these types of issues, though, we're taking trains from one community and possibly moving them to another. So clearly, we've heard some people that are opposed because they're going to get more trains. But it's also important maybe to hear from the folks that are going to be losing some trains because they're probably supportive. And so my question is really to you, Mr. Chair, are we going to be allowing equal time for both sides of this argument? I'm not familiar with where, people's positions are in regards to your testifier list, but my experience in the past has been on these very contentious issue, and when you have some communities that are benefiting and others that may not be, it's important that we give equal time to both points of view. Is that your intent today, or
Senator Peterson? Anyone who wants to speak will be allowed to speak. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Peterson. To that point, it would seem to me that this legislation is not attempting in the legislation to say put the burden elsewhere. It is simply saying conduct an environmental impact statement. And if you brought such a bill dealing with a project in St. Cloud, I would certainly be supportive of it.
Thank you.
And anyone else here as well. There is a lot of information that can inform a local community as well as the legislature in conducting such a study with regard to the impact on the whole state, quite frankly, any place where these railroads have track.
Senator Westrum.
Chair, real briefly, Senator Rest, did I understand from one of the earlier testifiers, this rail currently is used, but it's a short line rail coming from the Monticello area? And if you don't know the answer, as the testifiers talk, if they could just give us a little more
information, or is this actually a rail that has through trains on it, or did I hear right? Is it just a short line rail at this point in time?
As I understand from Mr. Sutter's comments, the BNSF line starts at Monticello and then goes into the city, and it's a northwest route. And the CP line is more heavily traveled. A couple of dozen trains a day go north of where the proposed connector would be built into Northtown and the Humboldt Yard, and they're asking for, since they share the track, and this is, you know, railroad talk, if you will, since they share the track, right now CP does not use that track that goes north-south, and what they want to do is take their east-west track that is at that point and turn it south onto the existing track that is used by BNSF trains 3, 4, 5 times a week, never on the weekends. So the connector would take the CP line, which is going running east, and turn it on to the BNSF line in Crystal in order to move their trains on a north-south route. So it's making a 90-degree turn, let's say, south from running eastward at 51st Avenue, 51st Place North and West Broadway in Crystal. And certainly those terms are extremely familiar to us that drive those streets every single day. And you could make descriptions of your community streets, and I probably would have a hard time following them, too. So we do the best we can.
All right. Mayor Harris, are you going to go first?
Thank you. Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Or Mayor Slavik.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I may be face and voice may be familiar to you since I'm up here on a regular basis, but today I'm here on behalf of the City of Golden Valley. I'm also joined, not sure where he is, but City Council Member Andy Snope is here as well with me. On behalf of the City of Golden Valley, I'm here to urge you to support Senate Files 886, 1074, and 1251. I'd like to thank Senator Rest and all the other co-authors for their support. I want to thank the chair for holding a hearing on this this situation as well. And, of course, I want to thank my fellow elected officials at all levels of government, federal, state, county, and city, for expressing their concerns on this and really being here in one voice. As you can see from the packet, Senator Rest referred to this earlier. The Golden Valley City Council recently passed a resolution expressing our community's concern for the proposed connector. We are united with our sister cities, as well as entities in the private and public sectors, in opposing increased rail traffic and increased hazardous materials going through our highly populated communities. We share the concerns on access problems this increased traffic will create for emergency responders, for businesses, for schools, for other community organizations that Mayor Murphy had referenced. There's also a concern in general for increased rail noise, vibrations, and, of course, as you can see, the potential for hazardous accidents. Specifically in Golden Valley, members, the older and relatively less used Burlington Northern Line passes by homes close enough where probably someone like a Teddy Bridgewater could probably throw a rock and hit the rail. It's really not, those homes are not that far from the line. We also have this line going adjacent to some very pristine nature areas like Mary Hills Nature Area, Theodoreworth Park, and Bassett Creek. And in fact, members may not know this, but Bassett Creek, some know this, Bassett Creek actually is actually travels under center field of Target Field. So heaven forbid there were some sort of accident, there were some sort of spill, we could have some significant problems. I'm not trying to be alarmist here, but after we've seen the alarming video of the recent train derailment in West Virginia, I am greatly concerned about the potential for these similar accidents happening, causing intense explosions and spills, severe damage to our environmentally sensitive areas, and probably the necessary evacuation of thousands of people. So, again, I urge your support of this legislation. I thank Senator Russ and the others for stepping forward and showing leadership and standing unified in one voice on this issue. Thank you for your time.
Mayor Slavik, right?
Slavik, yes.
Because, yeah, we know a Mayor Slavik as well.
I do, too. I was
used to hang around these parts. All right. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here on behalf of the City of Plymouth. And
you have to say your name.
Oh, it's Kelly Slavik, Mayor of Plymouth. Thank you. I'm here representing the City of Plymouth, and this Plymouth City Council has also passed a resolution in support of these bills, and I'm here today just to say that we do support an EIS here and are requesting that cities be allowed to participate in the process and be allowed to comment on the EIS. You've heard a lot about what the negative impacts that the connector would have on the communities surrounding Plymouth and east of Plymouth, and I won't reiterate all that in the interest of time, but that is still a major concern of Plymouth with these longer trains carrying hazardous materials that are coming through our community. We also have two schools along the CP rail. The CP rail is the one that runs through Plymouth. We have two schools there. One of them is Wayzata High School, which has almost 4,000 students there. Another is Providence Academy with over 1,000 students. So we're talking about 5,000 kids on school days that are very close proximity to this rail. There are also additional impacts, I think, that maybe we haven't touched on that we're not really aware of until we do this EIS. We really need to vet this out and make sure we know exactly what ramifications this may have on the communities. I want to talk a little bit about Plymouth's experience and what the situation that we have. And I think you have been provided with a handout that has this cool little car on it that we've prepared in Plymouth. And it's a situation that we have in Plymouth. Vicksburg Lane is a critical north-south connection in Plymouth, and it connects into another community, Maple Grove. And it really takes pressure off of 494 through our community. And that road is planned to accommodate over 15,000 vehicles per day. CP came in with little notice to Plymouth. They do not need our permission to make any changes. But they came into Plymouth, and the trains were currently traveling at about 20 miles per hour through our community. They wanted to make the trains go faster at 40 miles per hour. In order to do that, they had to take the flat tracks and bank the tracks to accommodate longer trains and faster trains. And they had to increase the super elevation on the curves as well. And the city, as I said, had no input. There was no coordination. And we were left with a very unsafe, as you can see from the photos, a very unsafe crossing for motorists. We had to, that Vicksburg Lane was a 50-mile-per-hour roadway. We had to reduce the speed to 30 miles per hour. We've done everything that we can to make that, to make motorists aware that there's, all of a sudden, they're going to be traveling down the road and they're going to, it really is a slope, and they can, their car can become airborne. If you look on the back page of my handout, you will see a vehicle that didn't heed the warnings and ended up in a crash. There, we have this very frequently. Also, you can see the pavement is severely damaged as cars bottom out when they approach the tracks. So we've had to deal with this in our community. There's about currently 20 to 30 trains over a mile long that travel on this road. The freight includes Bakken Oil. And the city has been forced to now construct a bridge over these tracks as the train speeds are expected to approach 60 miles per hour. The bridge will be at a cost to the city of $4.8 million. This is something now that we're going to have to absorb in a city where we're very mindful of our budget, and needed improvements to this road are coming, but in addition, we're going to have to expend these funds to build the bridge. So I just wanted to provide the experience that Plymouth has had with CP, and we didn't have an opportunity to really request an EIS or to have any involvement. The railroad just came in and started construction. We did reach out to our federal delegation and asked them for assistance, and they kind of threw up their hands at us and said there's nothing that we can do either. So I really hope that you give this a lot of thoughtful consideration and make the determination that an EIS would be necessary and allow the cities to participate as well. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the time and the opportunity to be here today.
Mr. Chairman, I do have just a brief comment from the mayor of Crystal as well. The community development director made the presentation, but Mayor Adams would also just like to make a very brief comment.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mayor. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, council members. I'd like to make a relatively brief statement. My name is Jim Adams. I'm the Crystal mayor, and I'm kind of in a unique situation. I have a different perspective, I think, than some of the mayors. John Sutter talked about emergency response. I am actually a West Metro firefighter, which serves New Hope and Crystal, and I have a pretty good bird's-eye view as how we operate within the communities of both New Hope and Crystal. We have two stations which are south of the CP line and one station which is north. And that is the full department. The problem that we're running into is the majority of our responders, obviously the two south ones are all south of the Canadian Pacific, but also our north station, half of those responders are on the south side as well. So when it comes to fire protection, I think we have a unique vulnerability between the two cities. We oftentimes offer mutual aid services to other communities to the north. We would now become a dependent city on services from people who are already relying on us. So there's a significant public safety piece of it that I want you to consider. And I'd like to ask on behalf of the city of Crystal that you support these bills as well. And that concludes my comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mayor.
Mr. Chairman, there are the next three people. I'm not sure I saw all of them in the room, but if they are here, I wish they would come forward. Mr. Ranieri from the City of Minneapolis, Mr. McAlpin from North Memorial Hospital, and Ms. McMillan, who is a Director of Government Affairs of the Twin West Chamber of Commerce, where I am a longtime member.
Great. Thank you. Why don't we take you in that order? Welcome, Mr. Ranieri.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. My name is Gene Ranieri. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the City of Minneapolis. We support Senator Ress's bill to do the EIS. It will impact concern about going right through Theodore Worth Park or near Theodore Worth Park, through the Bryn Mawr neighborhood, Target Center, Target Field, going right through downtown. But also as important is that this route will rearrange traffic now in our city. We have traffic, these rail cars, as you can see, the red line on the graph, going through the north side of our city. If this is built, this new proposed line is built, they're going right through downtown. So in response to the question, would this reduce traffic in the city? It will not reduce traffic in our city. It'll just put it in two different places.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. Chair, members, Buck McAlpin, Government Affairs, North Memorial Healthcare and Ambulance. North Memorial operates one of the largest EMS operations in the state. We have about 135 ambulances, 6 helicopters on duty across Minnesota, about 900 employees. And our largest service area is western Hennepin County, from the borders of lower North Minneapolis off Broadway all the way out through the borders into the edge of Wright County. Also, North Memorial is a level one trauma center serving the entire state with our helicopter operation. And western Wright County and Sherburne County, all those folks that funnel in down into that area. One of our concerns with hindering the access is currently now we have about 17 ambulances on duty at high peak, and in numerous occasions we go down to what's called one truck ambulance coverage, where one vehicle sits in a 42nd and 100 and covers the entire large service area. Anything that delays us responding to western Hennepin County from any changes to some of the rail lines would have quite an impact on us of how we do our operations. Secondly, we work closely with Hennepin County on what's called Ordinance 9 that requires some very strict standards for public safety of the citizens of Hennepin County of how we adhere to response times. And we have to report those response times quarterly to the county to be sure we make those. So we're just here to express our concerns about this expansion that North Memorial sees many, many critical patients where time is a factor. And anything that we do to jeopardize some of that time will impact the outcome and survivability of folks. Thank you.
So we'll just convert your entire fleet to helicopters and we solve the problem. put rotors on top of all the ambulances. How's that?
That's a great idea.
All right, Ms. McMillan.
Good afternoon. I'm Deb McMillan. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Twin West Chamber of Commerce. We represent more than 700 member businesses in the western suburbs of the Twin Cities. I'm here today to support the resolution requesting the Surface Transportation Board require the railroads to complete an environmental impact study on the proposed connector rail in Crystal. This proposed connection is anticipated to dramatically increase the frequency and length of trains carrying freight in a densely populated urban and commercial area. Among the businesses located along the rail line is Courage Kenny Rehabilitation Institute, which operates a residential long-term transitional rehabilitation care facility serving patients with complex brain and spinal cord injuries. Under this proposal, a single train has the potential to block multiple at-grade crossings several times each day, creating difficulty for businesses trying to move goods and people trying to get to jobs. Also concerning is the increased response time and decreased accessibility that is certain to occur in the event of an emergency, should that event correspond with the passing of a mile-long train through the community. We recognize that the railroads have an important role to play in commerce as well, and that through an EIS there will be a way to explore alternatives to encourage a compromise that meets the needs of all parties involved. The Twin West Chamber of Commerce, on behalf of more than our 700 member businesses, supports the request of the Surface Transportation Board to require an EIS for the project. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. McMillan.
Mr.
Senator
Chairman.
Westrom.
Yes, oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Question to the chamber. Do you have some alternative proposals that you guys would propose? And my guess is some of your businesses would benefit from the rail traffic that might be a part of their business as well or not.
Ms. McMillan.
Chair Dibble, Senator Westrom, yes, that's what the EIS would do. It would explore some of those alternatives and propose some of those options.
Senator Westrom. All right.
Mr. Chairman, next I have Mr. Qualley and Mr. Rice, and then we can take up those two bills.
All right, thank you. Welcome, Mr. Qualley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. I am Philip Qualley, State Director of the UTU, representing 1,400 conductors, switchmen, yardmasters, and remote control locomotive operators in Minnesota. In the interest of disclosure, as a conductor of 35 years who has worked the Monticello subdivision, I hold seniority rights on the rail line that is a primary focus today. As railroad workers, we want to advocate for system capacity improvements and advancements of railroad transportation. We are dedicated within our crafts to run the railroads safely without exception. We are also Minnesotans who care about our communities and public safety. We support the intentions of Senate Files 886 and 1074 to gain an EIS. With the carrier's proposed routing plan, disclosure of common carrier routing priorities and catastrophic emergency evacuation planning should be also mandated. As a brief profile, the BNSF Monticello subdivision is a remaining segment of the former Great Northern Main Line across North Dakota to Seattle. From the south end of the line at Lyndale Junction, the track along Bassett Creek remains in a low swamp. However, track geometry, engineering, and track subbase remain very good. Undercutting, new ballast, cross ties, and rail would be essential with any new traffic upgrade. The new proposed operation on the route will no doubt lead to holding, restricting, and red absolute signals on the CP line. This will lead to slow and stop trains with blocked crossings on the CP line. From our cursory review of the BNSF and CP mainline segments, trains will not fit between crossings. On the Monticello segment, BNSF, while there is only one crossing in the southern 3.5 miles, there are six crossings at the north and near the diverging route onto the CP subdivision. On the CP, west of the proposed turnout area, we count 10 grade crossings that could be blocked or face slowing trains. We also want to point out that north of the CP line, main line proposed turnout, on the Monticello sub, we count 7 grade crossings paralleling Botno Boulevard that could be blocked during the staging of standing of trains for meets with other trains south of the area. In other words, trains could come eastbound on the Canadian Pacific, pull down the Monticello sub, stop, switch be lined and the train reversed up the Monticello line to stage and hold. So we have other crossings we need to be concerned about in the community. We would also like to identify a potential, and to Senator Westrom's question earlier about the routing of the line, and while the BNSF has made no comment that this is their intention at this time, we also want to identify a potential for BNSF to expand their own track operations on the Monticello line. North of Monticello Town, the BNSF could connect to their Staples main line with less than 3 miles of track and a river bridge. This would result in the former GN line becoming a new separated main line route through the metro to the Dayton's Bluff interlocking in St. Paul. Regarding the current proposal before us, we assume the carriers will install power switches, and we question the reported 20 to 25 mile per hour speed of a number 20 track switch due to the radius and elevation of any turnout track at this location. There are two other areas I'd like to speak to briefly in closing on the subject of hazmat response. Nationally and at the state level, we focus on risk assessment. Attempts have been made to identify corridors where emergency response can concentrate and be prepared. Efforts have been made to detour routing of hazmat away from city centers whenever possible. The rerouting of unit oil trains and other hazmat through downtown Minneapolis is certainly an escalation of risk. Regarding CP routing alternatives, we encourage CP to consider continued improvements on their own CP Withrow subdivision. Their improvements last year is instructive, and double main line or siding capacity could be added on their existing corridor that is currently hauling hazmat materials. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you very much, and look forward to any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Qualley, questions? I just wanted to note for the record that we're happy to see Representative Lynn Carlson has joined us in the room. I think you've been here for hearing. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Carlson was here earlier, and then he had to leave, and I'm glad to see that he is back, too, and he is the he is my own representative, and the connector line is in his district, his Senate, his representative district, his House district, and we're also joined by our other House member, Mike Freiberg, who has the city of Robbinsdale. And I haven't looked behind me, but I don't know that he is here, but I have appreciated working with them as well.
Mr. Chair,
and,
to that point.
So I would ask you to hear testimony from Mr. Rice, and then also, because I believe she wants to speak about the EIS, from Kathy Velasquez-Eberhard, and I will request that they be extremely brief.
Thank you. So we'll hear from Mr. Rice and Ms. Velasquez-Eberhard, but we have a question from Senator Peterson.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, do you have a sense for how these bills are moving in the House related to all three of these? Have they been scheduled for hearings? Now that you have
Senator Rest.
Representative Carlson and Freiberg have the companions to the first two, the EIS, and I have understood that they have asked, they have requested hearings, and Representative Sarah Anderson of Plymouth is the chief author of Senate File 1251.
Great, thank you.
So the bills have been introduced, and it's my understanding hearings have been requested. But as you know, sometimes people wait for something to move in one body before they take it up in the other. And these bills, the first two bills, have been requested by the Committee on Environment, and so if the committee, this committee acts favorably on them, that's where they would go.
Thank you. Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Brian Rice. I'm here today representing the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. The Park and Recreation Board is independently elected in the city of Minneapolis and owns approximately 6,800 acres of land, 800 of which are in Theaterworth Park, and the map that's just been shown, Worth Park starts at 394 west of Minneapolis and goes all the way up past Golden Valley Road. And basically, we are a neighbor of the BN line and have been there for over 100 years. What's noteworthy on that map, if you look at it, you'll see the BN line runs adjacent to a number of wetlands, Bassett's Creek, Theaterworth Lake, and then it runs through Bryn Mawr Meadow, which is a neighborhood park in Minneapolis. It's wetland, it's parkland, extremely sensitive. We really think the small change, the railroads will say this is a small change, it's just a connector involving a little piece of land in Crystal. Actually, it's a huge change in the connection. Mr. Ranieri talked about the traffic. All does wind up in Minneapolis. From what we understand, this would increase traffic going through the city of Minneapolis. It seems to be the only reason why the railroads would pursue this. And if ever there was a case for an EIS, this is it, and that's why the Park Board would support it. I don't think this situation is much different when CP Rail tried to expand their rail line through Bloomington, through Rochester, to add coal trains going through that city. I think it's got a very dramatic effect for these communities and really does need to be studied. Thank you. Be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. All right.
My name is Kathy Velasquez Eberhardt. I will keep this brief. I appreciate the opportunity to speak. I represent a group of citizens, the Citizens Acting for Rail Safety. There's a group in La Crosse that's been active for about 2 years, and we're forming one here in the Twin Cities as well. Specifically, I live in the Como Park neighborhood, and we are one of those communities that already has rail, that already sees about 7 oil trains a day coming past our homes. We are in support of this EIS, however, for this community, and my main testimony here is to make sure you understand that this is already happening right in the heart of our city, and that we should consider ways to expand this EIS, if at all possible, to be looking at the entire region. I don't know what is possible, but I want to just let you know that with those 7 oil train cars coming through our community, it is the equivalent of a pipeline worth of oil that is going past our beloved Como Park, the zoo, the conservatory, the lake. It's going by high schools. It's going by homes within just a few feet. We had a meeting on Monday with our fire chief, and while we're very pleased with the preparedness of our first responders, he is certainly concerned, as are all of us. So I simply am here to bear testimony to the neighborhoods and people that are already facing the oil trains, as well as the increase in traffic, the congestion. There are children that go under the train track, under the trains when trains stop at the Como stop, and bikes, people coming from the lake who are walking around the lake who get blocked by trains carrying their bikes over the racks, over the trains that are blocked there. So it is certainly a terrifying situation that many of us are living in. All I simply ask is that you support this EIS and that we consider in any way possible ways that it might be expanded beyond just this region, to look at the entire Twin Cities region and to look at even the communities along the river. I know that the CARS group in Winona and La Crosse is particularly concerned about a marsh where the train is going as well. So that is simply all I wanted to get across today, and I really appreciate your time in letting me speak. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Velasquez Eberhardt.
Chairman?
Senator Est?
I'm in a quandary about how to suggest to proceed, because I know you wanted this hearing to end at 4, and Mr. Sweeney has not had the opportunity to speak yet, and we have the third bill to take up.
Right.
So what do you suggest?
We'll try to continue. We'll try to forge ahead. I would like to get these out of committee today. It would be nice if we got a bill or two out of committee today.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman, I would suggest then,
right.
And he can testify twice if he likes.
Right,
I have
right.
No objection to that myself, right. For Mr. Sweeney to speak about the two EIS bills.
Correct. So I'll invite Mr. Sweeney forward, and I'll also announce at this point I don't want to quash any testimony, so folks who want to make their way to the table who aren't on the typewritten list, start preparing yourself to come forward. Mr. Sweeney. Okay, we could have a page come forward and grab the hand. Welcome, Mr. Sweeney.
Good afternoon, Chairman Dibble, members of the committee. I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway in St. Paul. Would you prefer that I address all three bills or just limit my comments to
Thanks. Why don't you go ahead and testify to all three, if Senator Rest is all right with that, and that way we can, I'm sorry, yeah, or not.
Mr. Chairman, since I have not had a chance to present the third bill, I would prefer its testimony at this point be limited to the first two bills.
All right, very good. Mr. Sweeney.
Thank you. BNSF Railway opposes the two bills dealing with the EIS in that they would delay and prolong conditions in the state that that are interfering with our efforts to bring significant benefits to area communities by reducing block crossing problems, but also to our efforts to address service complaints and issues in the state that were very well documented in the past year. Service problems affecting commodities such as grain, taconite, coal, intermodal traffic, and also congestion problems that caused delays with North Star traffic. As was mentioned earlier, there has been a communication problem with this project. We apologize for that. We kind of tripped over ourselves and let word of the and rumor about the project get far ahead of our communication efforts. As a result, we've been behind the curve on this. I think it's important first to explain what is being contemplated for this location and what effect it would have on the state and the region. I believe it was September 30th last fall, this committee held a joint hearing with four other committees dealing exclusively with the issue of rail service issues in the state of Minnesota. At that time, I explained that we had a tremendous growth in traffic caused by a surge in demand for various commodities, and that the solution was a large-scale capacity improvement program. We spent better than $5 billion last year on our capital projects system-wide. Roughly $1 billion of that was for capacity improvements across our northern tier, particularly projects in North Dakota and Montana that did provide benefit for Minnesota traffic. I also noted that this year we contemplated launching several projects in Minnesota to increase capacity, such as double tracking projects, signal system upgrades, and so on. The project that we're talking about in Crystal is part of that package. On the second map, you see more of a regional layout of the rail system, BNSF in orange, CP in blue, centered around the Minneapolis-St. Paul region. This region has had tremendous growth in traffic, as I said, and because of our capacity constraints, we had a number of service issues. The next map, BNSF Capacity Improvement Projects, Savannah, Illinois to Dilworth, Minnesota. This shows a number of the double tracking and signal projects that we're going to be launching this year on the corridor from Dilworth, Minnesota down to Savannah, Illinois. This would be our track in Minnesota, also along the Mississippi River in Wisconsin. You'll see that there are several double tracking projects in there, including one on our Midway subdivision in St. Paul, a triple tracking project in St. Paul, also double tracking in the La Crosse, Wisconsin area. All of this to improve capacity and the flow of traffic. The next map, BNSF and CP current routes and trackage rights. This is the problem area that we're talking about today. What happened was years ago, Soo Line Railroad, which comes in from the west, acquired properties from the bankrupt Milwaukee Road Railroad, including a yard in St. Paul. To get from the Soo Line property to the Milwaukee Road property, that is now the CP system, they had trackage rights on BNSF Railway. So they had the right to move their trains across. What happens is when the trains come in from the west, the eastbound trains come in, they transition onto BNSF at the location, the purple block marked congestion area. That transition involves a couple of very sharp curves and very slow train speeds, less than 10 miles an hour. So it can take a CP train about 20 minutes to clear that that transition. All that time, that train is blocking both main lines for BNSF Railway. So about 12 eastbound trains a day that make that shift, we wind up losing about 4 hours during a 24-hour period where all of our traffic comes to a standstill. This causes congestion up and down the line. In Coon Rapids, for example, there have been many complaints about trains stopped on crossings for an extended period of time. Crossings going from Coon Rapids north on our Staple subdivision, that's the line that goes up to Coon Creek and then branches to the left. Also on our Hinckley subdivision, that's the track that goes up to Duluth Superior. That's one that branches off on the right. Both our St. Paul and Midway subdivisions are blocked by this. So a major Northtown yard, which is one of the four or five largest yards on our system, becomes paralyzed. Traffic in and out is stopped during the time that that this is taking place. So what we're proposing to do is move that point where CP trains come out to BNSF. On the next sheet, you'll see that what we're contemplating is the track that's been talked about at Crystal, about a 2,000-foot connection that would lead from the CP main line onto the Monticello subdivision. And those, right now it's roughly 12 trains a day, would head south on the Monticello sub through Crystal, through Robbinsdale, and so on, onto our Wayzata subdivision and go into Minneapolis. These are trains that are already going through the metropolitan area every day. They're just going through some other neighborhood. They're going over some other city's crossings, but they're already there. This isn't new traffic that we're bringing in and just putting in Robbinsdale. As I said, it's the goal is to improve the flow of traffic overall through the metropolitan area. It should provide significant relief for the crossing problems in places like Coon Rapids and north from there, free up probably some crossings on the CP main line as well. I can't really speak for them. But it should have significant improvement for the overall flow of freight. Otherwise, we can do all these other double-tracking projects and signal projects that I talked about so that everybody can hurry up and wait for this one bottleneck that would still be remaining in the Twin Cities area. So that's the problem that we're trying to solve with this project. The process that we would go through, we will have to file an application with the Surface Transportation Board. That body makes the determination of what level of environmental review is required. We'll comply with that. Whether it's an environmental assessment or an environmental impact statement, a lot of the same information that people have been talking about would be reviewed either way. It is that the EIS is a much longer system, a much more complex system, and frankly, it would prolong for a period of years, perhaps, a situation that last year we were told is, in no uncertain terms, was unacceptable. We were told that we were late in the game in addressing the problem, and we were. And now we're trying to take care of those problems. We're trying to fix those capacity issues. A comment was made that the goal is not to shift the burden to someone else. True, but the proposals would keep the burden the same size as it is and where it is and interfere with the ability to reduce the burden and spread it more equally so that, yes, there would be more trains on crossings, but you would get rid of the bottleneck that is currently causing those same trains to, or other trains, pardon me, to sit on other crossings for very long periods of time and cause many of the same problems that people are projecting may happen to them are already happening, and we're trying to get rid of those problems and eliminate them throughout the metropolitan area. So I would encourage the legislature to not interfere with the process by requiring additional studies that are not needed or encouraging studies that would do little more than delay and postpone the projects that the legislature, the state, and our customers have been asking for. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sweeney, can the Surface Transportation Board, can they request the environmental review now?
Mr. Sweeney.
Chairman Dibble, Senator, I'm not sure if they can if they can require anything now, and not until we have an application before them, I imagine. Right now, we don't yet have an agreement signed with CP. That's been part of what has held up these efforts for communication filing an application. But until we have something in front of them, I don't think they can. Now, we did have a couple of executives from our headquarters in town yesterday, and despite the wonderful weather, we did drive and walk the Monticello sub, the corridor. And, you know, these people took a look at it, and we met with Senator Rest and Senator Dietzick. We also met with the governor's staff and with the Department of Transportation and told them, you know, we understand that people obviously are not going to like this. We're willing to take a look and see if there is some other viable option. But right now, this is the one option we know of, the one option that we know would work. And so we would not want this particular option taken off the table while we're in the process of looking at other alternatives.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Sweeney, on page 3 of your document there, you have the purple square that points out the congestion area. So then is it safe to say that that's the line that right now there's congestion? This was to my earlier point, I guess. I'm not sure if you were here yet, but you know, my sense is, and a lot of times these projects, the congestion kind of moves from one set of communities, offers them some relief, and then maybe is increasing a little bit of congestion in some other areas. So is it safe to say any of the communities north or towards the top of this page going towards Coon Creek, going out to Coon Rapids, I guess I heard you mention, those communities would potentially have less congestion, and then a part of those trains would be moved to this new section. Is that accurate?
Close. It's what's happening is the trains that are coming in on the blue line from the left, as they go across the orange line coming down from the top of the page, they block the trains on the orange line heading north. Those trains would not, from that orange line coming down through Coon Creek, those would not be going through Crystal and Robbinsdale. What happened is the trains coming in on the blue line would be diverted over so that they wouldn't interfere with the flow of the trains on the other line. So it would bring relief to the situation in places like Coon Rapids and north from there.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 886 or Senate File 1074? Senator Westrum and Senator
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sweeney, what process do you go through if this bill doesn't pass? And if it does, what do you estimate the cost of an EIS to be? So first question, what do you go through to look at alternatives, or what have you talked to the parties right now about as alternatives, but what is the cost of this bill if it goes through?
Mr. Chair, Senator, frankly, I have no idea what the cost of an EIS would be. And really, the major problem with one isn't the cost, it's the time. As I said, the longer that the process of an EIS drags out, the longer the conditions that were termed unacceptable are going to persist. And that's the real problem with going to an EIS. A lot of the same information, as I said, would be considered in an EA versus an EIS. But there wouldn't be some of the requirements for the level of research into options and things like that, I believe.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My set of questions for Mr. Sweeney is along that same line. So how much of a delay do you think an EIS would cost you? And can you maybe give me a sense of, again, some of the differences between an EIS and an EA?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I will confess that I'm not really able to deal in any kind of depth at all about the complexities of one and specific requirements of one versus the other. With an EIS, however, there is the potential for a process that drags on for a period of years rather than months.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm certainly, over the last 12 months, I think you've made a pretty good case that we do need some additional capacity. We do need, not some, we do need additional capacity in our rail system. But I'll admit I'm also very concerned with what I'm hearing in the communities and the impact that this will have, and to make sure that we've got a process in place that will mitigate, particularly on the safety side of these long trains blocking up multiple routes for emergency vehicles as well as commercial traffic. So I'm not sure how, you know, without an EIS, how you might look to address that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, as I said, EA, my understanding, limited as it is that an EA does get into the same areas, look at many of the same issues. It's a matter of how far down you drill with them and how long the process will take.
Thank you.
Right. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, just some of the testimony we heard was blocked crossings or a change in the pitch of the rails and now a bridge required. Mr. Sweeney, is there opportunity to work with communities and maybe if I understood the Robbinsdale testimony, that four intersections would all be closed at one time. Is there a way to ensure that they have a bridge that gets across at least one of the main arteries to deal with the public safety and emergency type situations? Is that something you guys would engage in a partnership or cost share for things like that to benefit both you and them? I've got an intersection in my district and north of Glenwood, and they're looking at an overpass because of all the trains coming across. So I can see their issue, but I've also got farmers and cement retailers and businesses that are paying extra just to try to get their grain hauled, and the congestion is a real problem. And so a lot in this question, but just maybe should shed some light with what types of opportunities we could see you and the communities working on short of this bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator, short answer, I believe the question is, are we willing to work and see if we can address many of these concerns that are expressed? Yes, we are. We have in many locations across our system. It won't necessarily be a bridge. Frankly, from looking at the Robbinsdale area, I'm not sure that one could be shoehorned in, but perhaps there are other safety offsets that could be undertaken on some sort of cost-sharing basis to address the concerns.
So, all right. Members, I think we're pulling some of our members back. We're getting towards a vote. Senator Estia, why don't you come forward?
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of comments in response. I think the experience of Plymouth indicated that, all protestations aside, that the railroads do not have a very good record of working with local communities to mitigate their concerns. Secondly, surely there are some EISs that take a couple of years, but typically an EIS can be accomplished in 9 to 15 months. And Mr. Sweeney iterated again that the biggest, it seemed to me at least, the biggest difference, as did the vice president of BNSF, Mr. Nober, who visited with me yesterday, said that, once again, he said that the reason why opponents of or people who are concerned about these projects want EISs over EAWs is simply the length of time. But I indicated that with an EAW, you do not necessarily require, one of the reasons why it can be done quickly or more quickly is that alternatives are not studied and analyzed. Alternatives need not be studied or analyzed. With an EIS, they are. If you look at the maps that Mr. Sweeney showed you, I would want to see whether grade separation could be accomplished at those points where there is congestion, and relieve the congestion that way. Grade separation, because of the topography, as Mayor Murphy indicated, in Robbinsdale, that's not possible. They might like to do that, but it's not possible. And we could find out what is possible and other alternatives, indeed, for that the train crossings that go into Northtown, if there are other ways of relieving the congestion there that are different than just causing safety concerns in my communities, which I would support. We do not ask that BNSF avoid our communities. We appreciate the contributions that the railroads make to our economy, whether Senator Westrom is our agricultural economy, whether it is passenger trains, whether it is commuter trains. But we also think that this is such a major departure. A major departure, not a minor one, a major one, that the request for the for there to be an EIS by the Surface Transportation Board, which does have authority to order it of the railroads, if and when an application is made. And why would we want to say it ahead of time? We'd want to say it ahead of time because if we wait, then we're Johnny come lately to the dance. And so we, Governor Dayton, as well as the legislature, is saying in that circumstance, we would greatly appreciate, for the benefit of our communities and the people of Minnesota, quite frankly, that an EIS be conducted.
And the member of Congress who represents the area.
Yes. So that's the end of my comments.
All
and
right.
Mr. Chairman, unless other members have additional comments, I would have motions to make.
All right. Why don't you make those motions?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate file 886 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Environment.
All right. Questions on the motion? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senator Rest, I appreciate the effort you put forward with these bills, but from my perspective, I guess I would have to lean towards not supporting them at this point. You know, my perspective is that, you know, this committee has spent a great deal of time in the past asking the railroads to relieve this congestion, and I think this is a response to that, and it just seems a little counterproductive for us to tell them, well, no, I guess we didn't really mean that, and we're going to slow you down now in terms of relieving that congestion. You have heard on the record now they are willing to work with the communities. That's been my experience in St. Cloud. As I said, you know, we have, I think, 47 trains a day now with five crossings. They're high-speed trains as well, and we have four no-whistle crossings now in St. Cloud. We have one to go. They have worked with St. Cloud to help make that happen. In fact, they're working with the city of St. Cloud and Waite Park right now to sell us land for things like bike paths and add very significant improved features to the community that I serve and represent right now. And quite frankly, members, I'm not willing to play a part in prolonging this congestion if we have a solution here now that's coming forward, particularly when we have them on record saying they're willing to support and move that forward. And again, I think we've been shown we have a process in place through the Surface Transportation Board in an effort to solve these solutions. That's not taking anything away from the governor's office and his letter, as well as the congressman, and certainly whatever this committee decides to do. But we do have a process in place, members, to handle this now. So,
all right. Anything further? All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Oh.
Division.
Oops, sorry. I'm sorry. All right. Division has been requested. All in favor, please raise your hand. right. All opposed, please raise your hands. On a vote of 10 to 3, the motion passes.
Senator Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate file 1074 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Environment.
Thank you. Senator Rest, any questions on the motion?
Mr. Chair.
Peterson repeats his speech. Yep. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I voted in favor of the resolution asking for the Surface Board. The Surface Transportation Board take a look at this EIS and make a decision. Senator Rest, I understand your issue, but I'm going to vote against this particular provision because we've already acted on this, asking that be done, and it feels like we're kind of bypassing the process then and requiring it in state law then.
Mr. Chairman, there are two different processes, and with a state EIS and a federal EIS. And I do not understand yet all the nuances, but I have been assured by the by MnDOT that there are differences. We probably have in service of transparency, we have less chance of not being stopped at the federal level because they actually can do it. The railroads, some people say, always win, and they would probably, if we pass the second one, they would take us to court under the federal preemption. But I believe that we should try all avenues that are open to us, and perhaps we can convince the railroads that if they were not willing to have us or to approach the Surface Transportation Board, that they would be agreeable to a state one. And so I would like to keep that option open, requesting the federal one and then having the state one just to have the option open. But I respect your opinion, and I respect Senator Peterson's opinion too. We're asking for a study, and that means with an EIS that they can look at alternatives to reducing congestion in ways other than the CP connector in Crystal.
All right, thank you. Any further? All in favor of Senator Rest's motion on Senate File 1074, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Motion passes. All right.
Mr. Chairman, do we have
the rest? I think we can go quickly on
I would like
Bo 51.
Try. Yes.
5 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, there's an author's amendment to Senate File 1251
right.
that I would ask to be distributed as the A2 amendment.
All right. The A2 amendment is being distributed. This is an author's amendment from Senator Rest. Make sure that gets around, and then we'll vote on the amendments. All right, on the author's A2 amendment. Oh, I'm sorry, make sure it gets around. Opportunity to have it in front of them and glance at it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1251 came to me at the request, which I endorse, of Hennepin County. And I have with me Commissioner Mike Opat, who is the commissioner of District Number 1, where this project would take place. to present the county's case for with regard to the issues of eminent domain over property that is owned by the railroads or property that is owned by the county through which the railroad is proposing to proceed. So in the interest of time, I will just ask Commissioner Opat to go further into the motivation and the details of the bill rather than having him have to repeat what I say.
Thank you. What is your motivation, Commissioner Opat?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, thank you, Senator Ress, for getting this before us. I'm here. My name is Mike Opat. I am a Hennepin County Commissioner. I'm the chair of the county's Public Works Committee. I'm here. The county board yesterday took a unanimous position in support of this bill, and it really comes before us in light of the issue that you've heard about for the last hour or so. It's awakened the county board to the relatively weak and or unclear position the county has relative to railroads and their real estate activities. The bill seeks clarification of existing state law regarding the power of railroads to use eminent domain. It's a Hennepin County-specific bill. We don't want to, nor do we presume to speak for the other counties, and it's designed to be narrow and clarify the law in reasonable circumstances relating to public safety. So we'd ask your support. I'll go off script just a little bit, Mr. Chairman, and say that I represent the cities of Robbinsdale, New Hope, Crystal, Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park, and Osseo. We live with a lot of rail traffic. It's probably not 47 trains a day, but it's more than 12 that was mentioned earlier by the Burlington Northern representative speaking for Canadian Pacific. It's a Canadian Pacific line that's in stake here. I can tell you I've never met anyone from Canadian Pacific. I've never received a communication from Canadian Pacific. I live two golf shots from the Shingle Creek Yard, which is a Canadian Pacific yard, and we live with it, a lot of it. It's almost all of it's at-grade crossings through this city, and I think I wouldn't presume to speak for the mayors, but I grew up in this area. My whole life is in this area, and I understand the railroads, and I don't mind them. I understand that they're going to go through the area. But when they change routes like this, it's more than alarm. It's a life changer. It's a deal breaker. And it really makes for something that we have to stand up. And you've got four mayors here and a county commissioner, and there could be more to pack this chamber with this change. There have to be other ways to do this, and there's a need to clarify state law to make sure that the railroads cannot just go about their business without a notification of the local communities or by overriding local government. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions, members? Yep.
Senator, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't disagree with the commissioner. I think if we would work to get the word out on this bill further, we certainly would have people from the congestion that would benefit from the reduced congestion as well. So I would encourage you to try and look at it from both sides. So what would Senator Rest or the commissioner, what would you view as a public safety issue relating to the track? Is it in terms of, I think when we talked earlier, you mentioned something about having some access too close or people too close to the tracks. Is that an example of something that would be the county board might use to vote against or to turn back this condemnation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, I think the simplest one would suggest if the railroads wanted to expand their right-of-way over a county road.
Okay.
So there are a number. In this part of the world, Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, moving east-west is difficult because of actually the Burlington Northern Rail line, the seldom used line. But the county roads 9, 10, and others, and then the north-south lines, Winnetka is a county road, Douglas Drive is a county road, West Broadway is a county road, they all are cross at grade. There's not a grade, of those mentioned, none of those are grade separated.
Okay. Because I know certainly in Hennepin County you have bike paths that are within very short distance from rail lines, and certainly have bikers. And in this case, I think you're referencing pedestrians as well. So it sounds like your position would be to, I guess you can't speak for the other commissioners, but I guess that's a little bit of the irony of this. Certainly in Hennepin County you have, is one example I can think of bike paths, and pedestrian paths that are very, very close to railroad tracks. And quite frankly, the railroads were willing to sell that right-of-way to those communities to allow those features to go in. And I'm a little surprised to see Hennepin County going in the other direction at this point. So,
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, members, I would indicate that I will not support this bill for two different reasons. First of all, it provides for this law to be implemented retroactively. And I think that people and businesses have a right to know and understand what a law is at any given time. And when we begin implementing laws retroactively, it takes away the ability of people to rely on that concept. And so philosophically, I simply don't agree with approaching a resolution of problems by retroactively enacting laws. The other reason why I'm not in favor of this bill as written is I'm far from an expert on eminent domain and the authority of railroads when it comes to eminent domain, but it's my understanding that the state of Minnesota has seen fit to provide railroads with eminent domain authority, which is really quite unusual. Usually that is something that is reserved for the government, but in the past, the state of Minnesota has seen fit to provide that authority to railroads. The primary objection that I have, therefore, to this bill as it is written is we are singling out one county out of 87 and one project out of Lord only knows how many that this particular law would apply to. And I think that we ought not to be writing laws that just specify and single out when it comes to a law such as eminent domain. I think eminent domain, whatever we do, should apply equally to all counties and to all citizens, and not just to the citizens of one particular county to try and solve the problem encountered by the citizens of one particular project. And that's what's happening here. And so just from the application of a law standpoint, I don't agree with approaching solving the process in this fashion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Newman. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, with regard to the second issue, in my discussions with EQB, they actually also brought up the issue of whether this authority with regard to eminent domain should be available to other counties as well. And I think that is a worthwhile discussion, but the problem we have before us is solely within Hennepin County, and so that's why the bill is Hennepin County specific. And I'm certainly open to broader legislation either at another time or if I hear from other counties that want to have this this authority to consider that in the other committees that this bill would have to go to, and particularly in the Judiciary Committee on which Senator Newman sits, correct? Yeah. Who does have the jurisdiction over eminent domain law. So if there is expansion of this requested by other counties, I'm certain it can be covered in the Judiciary Committees, and I would await hearing from more specifically from the EQB and also from other counties if they would like this kind of input into a process and a project like the like CP, and who also has not approached anyone, but CP and or BNSF are proposing.
And I'll just say for the record, utilities as public service corporations also have eminent domain condemnation authority. not quite as unusual. I don't know how unusual it is for railroads to have it in a particular state. Anything further, members?
Mr. Chairman, I know that Mr. Sweeney had indicated he'd like to testify on this bill, too.
So anyone who would like to testify on Senate File 1251, please make your way to the table, and in particular, Mr. Sweeney. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Company in St. Paul. We are opposed to this bill. This is an obvious attempt, we think, to find some way to give Hennepin County the ability to veto a project that has potential benefits for the crossings in other counties. Anoka County, for example, should see substantial relief from a block crossing situation with this project, and yet one county would be given the right to veto that project. We think that this needs to be addressed in a more regional manner. All the pluses as well as all of the minuses need to be considered, not just the interests of one county. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sweeney has just explained why my reasoning is sound in that the laws involving eminent domain should apply equally to all counties. I would also indicate, Mr. Chair, I know that public utilities do have eminent domain. What I was trying to point out is that it's unusual for a private business, of which railroads are, to have the eminent domain authority. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well,
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Newman, Senator Newman, well, utilities are private businesses, too. They're just a regulated monopoly. And, well, we won't get into all of the rationale
Chair, Senator,
why these ancient powers are conferred to these very powerful industries.
So, railroads typically have been given the power of eminent domain in just about all of the states, I think, along with other companies.
All right.
So,
Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, if there's no further discussion, I would move that Senate File 1251 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on the Judiciary.
All right. To Senator Rust's motion, anything, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no?
No.
Motion passes.
Well, the division.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Division has been requested. Everyone in favor, please raise your hands. All opposed, please raise your hand. Chair's hearing is not fading out too quickly. On a vote of 9-3, the motion passes. Members, we are adjourned.